Feinschmeckertouren, Folge 147.
Feinschmeckertouren.
Der Reise- und Genuss-Podcast für Menschen mit anspruchsvollem Geschmack von Bettina Fischer
und Burkhard Siebert. Hier lernst du außergewöhnliche Food- und Feinkostadressen, Weine und Restaurants kennen.
Begleite uns und lass dich von kulinarischen Highlights inspirieren. Hi, hallo, schön, dass du wieder bei uns bist. Heute haben wir eine ganz besondere Folge für dich. Wir haben hier in der Nähe von Charlottesville eine amerikanische Podcasterin getroffen, die mit ihrem Kollegen Levi Dalton zusammen einen Podcast macht, der heißt I'll Drink to That, Talking Wine. Die beiden sprechen über Wein. Und wir haben sie heute im Interview. Sie wird dir ganz viel erzählen über Monticello Wine Trail, über die Weingegend rund um Charlottesville, vielleicht ein bisschen was über Loudoun County, aber auf jeden Fall über die unterschiedlichen Wineries, die es hier gibt. Ja, wahrscheinlich hat sie ein paar Tipps für dich, für die einzelnen Rebsorten, welches Weingut du auf jeden Fall besuchen solltest, wenn du hier in der Gegend bist. Und wir werden das jetzt gleich in Englisch machen, das Interview, weil sie einfach, ja, in der hauptsächlich amerikanisch spricht, nur ganz wenig Deutsch. Für mich und für Burkhard ist es eine Premiere. Burkhard kann deutlich besser Englisch wie ich. Für mich wird es ein bisschen so eine Sache werden. Also bitte entschuldige, wenn mein Englisch so eher was einfacher Englisch sein wird. Aber das macht ja nichts, weil du wirst ja trotzdem ganz, ganz viele interessante Informationen hören. Und dann sage ich einfach jetzt mal, jetzt geht's los, hör zu und freu dich auf diese Folge. Hi Erin, nice to meet you and to have you in our podcast show.
Guten Nachmittag, meine Freundin. It is so wonderful to be here and I'm happy to talk to you all. I'm so happy that we met.
Yeah, we too. Me too. Thank you. That was really fun to meet by random here at the Clifton. And so we are really happy to get some really inside information from you as a wine enthusiastic and a wine expert from this area. And yeah, that's what we came for. We read about the Monticello Wine Trail, that is the birthplace of American wine. What's that? Why?
So to get to the heart of the matter, it's kind of fascinating. The first grapevines and first vines sort of made in the United States were technically in Florida when it was Spanish Empire and in California. So those date back to like the 1500s. For the colonies, when the colonies first were established, the first territory was Virginia. And the first wine, what happened in the early 1600s, like very early 1600s, and the very first wine that was made from native grapes, so grapes that were already growing here in Virginia. But the interesting thing to note is that that place where those grapes were made is actually Maine today. Oh. So Virginia used to be much bigger. Okay. The very next year, grapes were made from grapevines here in this area, in some of the colonies closer to the coast near the Chesapeake Bay watershed. There were many attempts at wine throughout the years. Early producers at Jamestown Colony, each person that lived there had to plant 10 vines by law to contribute to the economy of the early colony. And but everybody had trouble making wine, and the wine trade never really quite took off in those early days. A few people had more success with other crops like apples. So there was a lot of cider being drunk in the early days, a really interesting cider, and some imported wines such as Madeira. So these things kind of came over in ships, and that's what people were drinking. Some vines were planted at Monticello, at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. And what they didn't realize was that there was a bug that lives in our soil called phylloxera that you may have heard of. And phylloxera eats the roots of European grapevines, but the grapevines here are immune. So the grapevines kept dying and nobody knew why. So it took some time to figure out that it was this bug that was the culprit. By the time they kind of figured that stuff out, some people had learned how to plant grapes. In Rockingham County, which is close to here, maybe about an hour away, a Frenchman came over. His last name was Sherdlin, and he planted a big vineyard in the early 1800s. I want to say circa 1815, but it's a little unclear in the records. So I just know it's early 1800s. And when he sort of passed on, a bunch of other companies moved in and started planting vineyards on the same area. They weren't planting European grapevines. They were planting hybrids and local grapevines. Some of the most popular grape varieties were grapes that you hear about a little bit today, like Scuppernong and Delaware. Really interesting grapes that aren't necessarily part of today's winemaking traditions. So there was a lot of wine being made in Virginia right up until Prohibition. And Prohibition is the same story everywhere in the United States. I think you're very glücklich in Deutschland because you didn't have a Prohibition, right?
Yes, no Prohibition. That's right.
So in Prohibition, we weren't allowed to make or have alcohol aside from sacramental reasons. So it instantly shut down this booming wine trade in Virginia, the booming wine trade in New York, and the booming wine trade in California. And there was really some momentum happening back in those days because a local grape, a grape that is born here called Norton, actually won one of the world fairs in Europe. So there was a definite momentum of Virginia wine trade. But things kind of stopped with Prohibition. And then, you know, the early part of the 1900s was just not good with, it was Prohibition, the Great Depression, World War I and II, and just all sorts of crazy stuff. In the 1940s, a veteran who had been in, who had traveled along the Rhine, moved back to Virginia, and his name was John June Lewis, and he planted a vineyard here and was one of the first post-Prohibition wineries. There was also another early winery in Maryland called Bordy Vineyards, and they've been making wine for a long time as well. They're not Virginia, but they're kind of in the same region, you could say. And then in the 1970s, boom, 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 all these wineries kind of sprouted up. And that was the start of today's modern Monticello wine trail that you're visiting today. So there's been an interesting history with spurts and stops and goes and stops. And then finally, I feel like we've arrived in this really interesting place where there's a lot of successful wineries. But it's grown so fast. So in a matter of 30 years, we've gone from something like 50 wineries to over 250. So it's extreme growth in how many wineries are here. And when you look at the products that Virginia makes, because I'm in the wine business, I always see wine everywhere, grapes everywhere. And so I think, oh, grapes must be one of our top products. But when you actually look at the agriculture numbers, grapes are, I think, in the 20s. So we're actually quite, this state produces other things. Like we produce, our top production is broilers, which are chickens, little chickens for eating. And then we do turkeys. So we're really known for poultry, if you look at the numbers. And then wine grapes are a little bit farther down. But still, it's a very important part of the industry for its extreme growth.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, but when the vineyards are very young, it's hard to get much flavor out of it, though, isn't it?
So that's an interesting concept that we could do a whole podcast about. I've heard some winemakers say that in a new vineyard, you'll get a lot of growth and a lot of really interesting, juicy grape flavors. So, for instance, a Viognier from a young vineyard would taste almost like pure Viognier. But a Viognier from an old vineyard would taste a little bit different, maybe more mineral-driven, something like that. Young vineyards do produce quite a bit in their early years. Typically, you would not get fruit that you could make wine from in year one or two, but usually by the third year, you're into production. And usually by year 10, between 10 and 20, you get some decent fruit that you can really make some nice wines with. Here, there are a lot of new vineyards, but there are also, we're starting to have old vineyards, and I think that's going to usher in a new era of local wine here as the roots get deeper and the wines become more complex.
Okay. Yeah, we had some tastings already, and also the vineyard, which is one of the oldest here, they told us, it's raised in 1978, which is comparably old, you know, to the others here. And they had the red wines, especially, were deeper than others we tasted here. But which grape varieties are typical for here? What does the region makes interesting for a European wine lover to come here? Hmm. But can he get here in comparison to France, Italy, or somewhat? What else? And what are the differences?
What defines the region in terms of wine? I think your listeners, or the people listening, perhaps you're from the Mosel, where Riesling is sort of the popular grape. So perhaps you're from Franken, where Silvaner is the main grape. I wish it was as simple to describe it here, but it's actually not. So the EU typically will limit the wines you can produce in your region based on grape variety. So, you know, you'll only be able to, if you want to label it from this region, you have to make it, you have to follow certain rules. Well, this is sort of like the Wild Wild West. We don't have too many rules. We do have some rules, but they're definitely not as strict as, well, they're definitely not as strict as the Pratiquet system. Super strict, super strict. But the so it's hard to pick one or two grape varieties that we are good at. Early in this new era of the wine industry, the Virginia wine folks tried to center in and narrow in on grape varieties that would do well here. And early on, they chose Cabernet Franc and Viognier. And in fact, Viognier was named the state grape, I believe, in 2011. Since then, there's a lot of winemakers have kind of talked and said, you know what, those grapes don't necessarily work the best here for this soil and this climate. And as they're getting into decade two, decade three, and they're learning more and more, they're discovering that other grape varieties do well here as well, such as Petit Manseng. Petit Manseng is great here. Albarino is a new thing. Like, everybody's planting Albarino because it just does well in the climate here. It grows. You don't have to do too much to it in the vineyard. When you plant grapes that don't grow well here, you end up having to spray a lot. The wines just don't taste as good because you have to sort of force wine out of those grapes. So you want grapes that suit the area. And over time, we're figuring out what grapes do best here. A lot of early producers on the Monticello wine trail, they first planted Cabernet Sauvignon. And then they learned that it doesn't grow quite so well here, Cabernet Sauvignon, that Merlot does much better. So in the beginning, there was this sort of vision of, you know, everybody wants to have Cabernet Sauvignon, but it's just, we're not going to get it to the ripeness levels that it needs to be every year to make good Cabernet Sauvignon. So what you end up seeing is a lot of Cabernet Sauvignon Rosé, people picking a little bit earlier. And then over a few years, when vineyards get replanted, people will typically change grape varieties towards something that works a little bit better. So we have a lot of Merlot and Chardonnay in Virginia. If you look at quantities planted, you'll see that Merlot and Chardonnay are kind of like in the top quantities. Petit Manseng is growing. So those are the most popular grapes. But what are the grapes that everybody talks about? It's still kind of Cabernet Franc and Viognier, although that's changing. And another thing that's interesting, that I think would be interesting to you and your listeners, is that Virginia used to be really focused on the tobacco trade, so lots of tobacco fields, but now it's not so good to smoke anymore. Are you having this in Germany too? No smoking
yes.
restaurants? Yes.
All of them.
Mm-hmm. So as the tobacco fields dwindle, there's new crops coming in, there's small boutique farmers, we're having boutique cheese makers come in, so we're having these interesting cheese farms making beautiful goat cheeses and lovely local cheeses. We're having small farmers specializing in heirloom ducks, heirloom cattle, grass-fed beef. So really interesting source products. And combine this with the fact that we're so close to that Chesapeake Bay watershed where the Jamestown settlers first came in and set up their colony. They came into the colony, and in that Chesapeake Bay, you have an immense bounty of mussels, of crabs, of soft-shell crabs, all sorts of delicious things coming out of the Chesapeake Bay. Oysters, there's a whole oyster company that's arisen. So what we have is this new era of cuisine in Virginia that takes this ancient Chesapeake Bay tradition and mixes it with a new farm tradition of cattle and ducks and cheeses. And then we're adding wine and cider and breweries on top of that. So it's difficult. Back to your original question, what are we all about? It's hard to define because we are discovering that right now. Like, you are watching the discovery. It's very cool. It's a very interesting time to be in. So if you go to, for instance, Sancerre, it's a classic pairing to have Sancerre Sauvignon Blanc with goat cheese. If you go to Bordeaux, it's a classic pairing to have the Canelée with the Sancerre. Here, we don't really have classic pairings yet, and we're trying to discover them. So I think that as time goes on, we're really well known for soft shell crabs, cheeses, these other interesting products like grass-fed cattle, and the wines here, we need to create pairings that bring them together to make the wine scene part of a larger Epicurean dialogue, okay. I think. That makes sense, yeah.
That's interesting. So it's an experimental road.
Mm-hmm. So we are in an increasing region. We are all right with our Feinschmeckerturm in a gourmet region. If there's growing up all the new food, the new production. And we came these days from Loudoun County and we visited a few wineries. Especially for me is the grape Viognier. I like it so much, these wines. What is the difference between the wines from Loudoun County and from Monticello? Hmm. Is there a difference?
There is a big difference. I had said earlier we have difficulty growing Cabernet Sauvignon here. It's not really the case in Loudoun County. They can grow it quite well, and especially if you have the right mountainside site. And essentially, if you look at a map of Virginia, you're going to see a mountain range like this. And then you have the Chesapeake watershed right here. Monticello's kind of here. It's in the middle. It's exposed. So we have the water and then this exposed site here. And we also have these sort of flatter areas with thick red clay. You've probably seen the red clay as you've been driving around. It's not everywhere here. Sometimes if you get into the hillier sites, you'll get into a different type of soil. And then once you get to the mountains and you go over the mountains, it's always 10 degrees cooler. And Loudoun is kind of up here, protected. Mm-hmm. Another thing that happens is across the Atlantic, hurricanes come every so often. In fact, this past year, we had just had so many, I couldn't even believe it. but they come up like this. And then they hit the Shenandoah Valley Mountains, and a lot of the storms don't really get to the other side. So, but we are right in the path of those storms. So we'll tend to get more heat, 10 degrees hotter typically, and we'll tend to get more precipitation. Whereas in Loudoun, it's a little bit drier, a little bit cooler, and a little bit higher. So they can grow different grapes there than we can grow here. I hope that answers your question.
Absolutely.
And Loudoun is also very close to Washington, D.C. So here we have the Monticello Wine Trail, but Loudoun's about a 45-minute drive from D.C. So typically you'll get a lot of people going out for day trips to D.C. to Loudoun County and to visit all the different producers there. And if anybody wants to visit a place there that's really interesting, we've talked about Linden Winery, which is one of my favorite wineries. The owner of that winery, Jim Law, planted his first vines in 1980, and he's a real leader for the state in terms of high-quality production. He makes a barrel-aged Chardonnay that reminds a lot of people of a rich Burgundy. He makes red blends, blending Cabernet and Merlot and Cabernet Franc together to make Bordeaux-style blends, and they're just, as you've tasted, because I poured you a sip, they're extraordinary wines. Nearby, you'll find a restaurant called Field and Main. And Field and Main is a restaurant set up in an old building. The building has a hearth, a fireplace that dates back to the 1700s. And so at this restaurant, they cook all the food on the fire hearth the same way it would have been cooked back in the 1700s. So it's so interesting because you'll get vegetables that are fire roasted or meats that are roasted over the fire. There's all these hooks and you constantly have to move items higher and lower so they don't burn and so they stay the right temperature.
Okay. Cool.
So it's a fascinating restaurant and it's delicious. And the that restaurant also has one of the top selections of local Virginia wines. So maybe perhaps on your way back north, if you stopped there, you'd get to see all these local wines and check out the food there. It's pretty fascinating.
Oh, that's a pity that we hadn't the chance to get there. It sounds so good.
That's the same I thought.
Okay, so we have to come again.
Well, perhaps some of your listeners will get there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I had you gave me the wine yesterday, and the red cuvée from this winery. It was really excellent. It reminds me of a good. I have some of the Bordeaux from 2005. We were there in Saint-Emilion and Côte de Blaye and so. And we have still a few bottles in our wine cellar of that. That was a great vintage. It reminds me a bit of that. This was really good. I have seen other wineries or other wines. They are described as more Italian style or something like that. Does the wine growers here are looking for a certain direction, maybe Bordeaux style or maybe Tuscan style or something? Or is that just to make also a wine like this? And do they also develop their own style?
That's a great question. In any emerging wine region, there's a search for identity. And we see this in emerging wine regions around the world. For instance, Central Otago in New Zealand has aligned itself very closely with Burgundy. But at the same time, they don't want to say we're just like Burgundy. They want to have their own thing. The Margaret River has aligned itself closely in Australia with Bordeaux, but at the same time, they don't want to say, oh, we're Bordeaux, we're the Margaret River. So it's difficult to establish your identity as unique when you're using grape varieties that are from other places, essentially. Here in Virginia, there's a few people trying to do their own thing. Like, I believe you tried Chrysalis, yes?
Yes. Yeah.
So at Chrysalis, there's a big, heavy focus on the Norton grape variety, which is a local Virginia grape. So there's one example of one winery kind of seeking to forge a new, very clear and individual identity that isn't really based on anywhere else in the world. From what I've seen in emerging wine regions, in the very beginning, wineries will attempt to compare themselves to other regions, just to give drinkers a benchmark. This is sort of what we're going for, this is what we're like. But ultimately, the goal and the job of the wine region will be to establish its own identity. Where your listeners are from, the grape material is different. You know, like, you don't really, like, you have Riesling in the Mosel, you have the Silvaner in Franken, you have Sauvignon Blanc in the Loire in Bordeaux, you have Pinot Noir in Burgundy, and you have Pinot Noir in Champagne, but you don't really have Pinot Noir in Bordeaux, and you don't really have Riesling in the Jura, and you don't really have Silvaner in Burgundy. You know, it's just everything's kind of neatly defined, but because our wine cultures tend to take cuttings from those vines and use the same plant material, it makes it more difficult to search for identity. So really what we have to do is find what makes our soils unique, which isn't necessarily regional. You know, the soil at one winery might be different from another. And find the overarching story of Virginia wine. And I sort of mentioned it earlier, but to me, that story is intertwined with food and with this emerging cuisine that's happening. I have a few pictures to show you as well. 1607 was when that first wine was made in Maine, that was Virginia.
Yeah, okay.
This is that mountain range you can see here. Okay, so here's Virginia, this little triangle. You can see the mountains come right down here, and Virginia's in this green part right here. Mm-hmm. And the Chesapeake Bay watershed is here, and Loudoun County is up here, kind of on the other side of that ridge. Here's another look at the same thing. So you see, this is where all the oysters and the mussels and the crabs are, and where the first colonies were. And then Charlottesville is kind of like right here in the Piedmont. Oh, there's Charlottesville. You see it? Mm-hmm. So Charlottesville is right up above those mountains, and then these are those big mountains, and there's ridges and ripples. And this here is some of the oldest land that exists on the planet. Millions and millions and millions of years old rock is right here. So it's kind of fascinating. But Charlottesville's right in that shadow, and so you can see any weather that comes up hits us right here, whereas Loudoun is a little bit protected. So this is where that first wine was made up here, which is today Maine, but this used to be Virginia. And then this is where that Chesapeake watershed is, where the 1608 wine was made. And this is a really interesting map. So you can see this map of Virginia, and you can see the Chesapeake Bay watershed here, and this is the Atlantic. And look at how they drew the map. They drew it as if they were in a ship seeing the coast of the land going into the Chesapeake Bay watershed. So this map of Virginia, to me, is fascinating because it shows how important this sea area is for the cuisine and the wine here and for everything here. This is an example of a Norton grape, and Norton won the best red wine of all nations at the Vienna World's Fair in 1873. The best red wine of all nations. From here.
Cool.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, absolutely. That is.
This is John June Lewis. He's the veteran that I told you who traveled along the Rhine and was inspired by the wines he tried there and planted grapes here in the 1940s.
Okay.
And these are some of the early winemakers in the 1970s. Here we see grapes produced. This is a graph that shows grapes produced. So you see just a very slow growth, and then boom, tons and tons of grapes produced. So this graph clearly shows the explosion in our grape agriculture. And this is that list of products that I was telling you about. So grapes are number 17 right here, whereas broilers or chickens are number one. Kind of neat, huh?
Yeah.
But still, even though we have a very robust agriculture, it's interesting to note that less than 16 cents of each dollar, so if you spend a dollar, only 16 cents will typically go to the farmer. So essentially, like, the farmers aren't really close enough to the chain to really benefit from all this. So we're not quite there yet. You know, some changes need to be made. Soft shell crabs from the Chesapeake. Also, there's, like, ham biscuits are kind of a local delicacy here.
Oh, okay.
And I think ham biscuits, Virginia ham, pairs so well with Viognier. I think oysters from the Chesapeake Bay go so well with Petit Mansang. And I think Virginia turkey is a great pairing with Cabernet Franc. So this is an emerging cuisine here.
Mm-hmm.
Even back in the 1800s, broilers, or these fried chickens, were super popular along the C&O train line here. So the trains would come in, and can you see the hats of the people? On top of those hats, there's trays with fried chicken on top. And there's a little hole in the middle where you put your money. So if they walk by the train, people reach out of the train and put their money, and then take a chicken.
That's funny.
The original fast food.
Yes. Yeah.
Here's another interesting thing. So in the U.S., there are certain dishes that you find all over the whole country. And these things you can go into.
Und welche Gerichte das tatsächlich sind, wie ein junger, schwarzer, amerikanischer Küchenchef die amerikanische Standardküche mit europäisch beeinflussten Rezepten bis heute ganz nachhaltig geprägt hat, nach welchen saisonalen Genüssen die Feinschmecker in Virginia ganz scharf sind, welche Weine natürlich dazu passen, die ja Insider-Geheimtipps von Aaron Scala zu ganz besonderen Weingütern auch in der Region und natürlich ein Haufen Tipps zum Schlemmen und Genießen in Restaurants in Charlottesville und Umgebung. Das hörst du alles im zweiten Teil unseres Interviews mit der Sommelier und Weinkennerin Erin Scala. Bis dahin viel Spaß beim Genießen, genieß die Zeit und bleib vor allem gesund. Ciao!
Hier endet dein Genusserlebnis noch lange nicht. Komm rüber auf unsere Homepage feinschmeckertouren.de und schau dir die Bilder zu unserer Show an. Dort findest du auch wertvolle Links zu den heutigen Empfehlungen.
Verpasst keine Neuigkeiten mehr und trag dich am besten gleich in unseren Newsletter ein. Wir freuen uns auf deine Anregungen für weitere Episoden und einen regen Austausch mit dir.
Viel Spaß beim Genießen, denn du weißt ja,
wahrer Reichtum besteht nicht im Besitz, sondern im Genuss.
Deine Feinschmecker-Guides Bettina
und Burkhard.
Wie viele Kaffees waren es heute schon? Kaffee spielt im Leben vieler eine sehr große Rolle. Und das nicht nur zu Hause oder im Café, sondern auch am Arbeitsplatz. Dafür gibt es Lavazza Professional. Kaffee am Arbeitsplatz, der genauso lecker schmeckt wie in eurem Lieblingscafé. Die perfekte Kaffeelösung für jede Art von Unternehmen. Klein, mittel, groß. Ihr habt auf jeden Fall einen Kaffee, der schmeckt. Die richtige Motivation für eure Arbeitstage. Alle Infos zu Lavazza Professional findet ihr auf lavazzapro.de mit allen Kaffeelösungen für euer Büro.
Ich habe mich natürlich schockverliebt, weil die war wirklich ganz, ganz klein.
So begann die Mensch-Hund-Beziehung zwischen Christina und Tierschutzhund Frieda. Und wie es danach, nach dem ersten Moment der Verliebtheit, so weiterging und welche Klippen es danach zu umschiffen galt, das hört ihr in der neuen Ausgabe von Iswas Dog, dem Podcast für harmonische Mensch-Hund-Beziehungen.
Iswas Dog mit Malte Asmus.
Überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.